This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, I have a conversation here in the studio with Valparaiso University School of Law Professor Jeremy Tellman. He'll tell us more about the 2018 Martin Luther King Jr. Lecture, which is coming up on Thursday on campus. And this year, it features Professor Henry Richardson III of Temple University. We'll also, of course, have another installment, another conversation from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. And we'll also have a conversation a little later with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. She talks about a number of things, among them the opioid epidemic and economic development, as well as finding out more about how NIPSCO is helping people who have trouble paying their heat bills, how to keep the heating going. That and more coming up, but first the news. Originally speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Chris Nolte. The 2018 Martin Luther King Jr. Lecture is coming up on Thursday afternoon at Valparaiso University. It'll be in Wazerman Hall. And to tell us more about the lecture series, as well as this year's guest speaker, we have from the Valparaiso University School of Law, Professor Jeremy Tellman. Thanks for being with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit about the series itself and how important it is in the overall effort that Valparaiso University puts on every year to note the life and the work of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Well, I've been at Valparaiso University Law School for 14 years now. Before my time here, the law school was always part of the MLK celebrations at VU. We had our own activities going on that were a sort of supplement, more law-focused to the university's MLK events. Mm-hmm. Beginning in 2005, which is right around the time I got here, we decided to establish a lecture series where we would bring a leading voice representing diverse perspectives, underrepresented minorities, women, to present their perspectives on legal issues. So every year we invite usually an academic, sometimes it's practitioners, who lecture on some subject that's relevant to the continuing legacy of MLK.
Can you tell us about some of the people who have been lecturers in the past?
Yeah, we've had amazing lecturers. Last year it was Angela Anwuachi-Willig, mm-hmm. Who gave a really fascinating talk that's now been published comparing the Trayvon Martin killing to I'm blanking on the name of the mm-hmm. boy who was killed, Emmett Till.
Oh, yes.
The Emmett Till killing. Not just sort of the brutal way in which they were both murdered, but also actually looking at the demographics of the people responsible for the murders. Very interesting parallels. It was a really great talk. In the past, we've had Brian Stevenson, who's, I think, the leading death penalty lawyer in the country, who's very inspirational, has done amazing work in Alabama, and is now focusing on the incarceration of juveniles in our country. We had Bill Nelson, who was my mentor at NYU, one of the leading legal historians in the country, has done pioneering work on the different forms slavery took, both in the antebellum period and in the colonial period. Mm-hmm.
Have we had any from Northwest Indiana or the Midwest here that have come in to speak?
So just most recently, we had Terry Smith, who's a distinguished professor of law at DePaul. We had Karen Freeman Wilson. I'm sure you mm-hmm. know who that
oh,
is.
Oh, yes.
She was great. Really fun to have her here.
And then she, not only is she now, of course, the mayor of the city of Gary, but she worked for a time was also Indiana Attorney General.
Right.
Back in the 1990s. So she obviously knows her stuff when it comes to talking about the law, to be sure. Now, this year, we come to 2018. Who is the lecturer this year? And tell us the importance of having him come to campus.
It's a tremendous honor to have Professor Richardson, Henry J. Richardson III. I might call him Hank because those who know him call him Hank. Mm-hmm. He's a towering figure. He is probably the most important scholar, African-American scholar of international law. He's been a practitioner. He's been in the – he was an advisor to the Carter administration on African affairs. He's been engaged as an advisor to, you know, new governments in African countries. He was the first African-American president of the American Society of International Law, which is the leading organization for the study of the study and the practice of international law in the United States. And then since, I think, 1981, he's been a professor at Temple. He wrote a monumental book, a 500-page book called The Origins of African-American Interests in International Law. It is sweeping magisterial history. The depth of the research is just extraordinary.
You mentioned before our conversation that you had a chance to review the book and you were able to tell him that, I guess. And what did you be able to tell him about what you found in going through the book itself?
Well, so that's a good segue to the lecture. I mean, what he calls the African-American interest in international law is actually an interest in what he also calls higher law. Mm-hmm. So it's this tradition of African-Americans saying, you know, the laws of this country are unjust. It can't be that legal systems permit the enslavement of other human beings or the discrimination against other human beings. And we know that there are higher laws there that we can call upon that ought to trump these unjust domestic laws. And international law is one source of those higher laws. And of course, despite the fact that his book, 500 pages though it is, ends in 1812, so there's clearly another 500 page or so volume to be written. He starts the book invoking Martin Luther King, who also employed this language of a higher law.
When you had a chance to go through this information and coming up with the speaker, did it take much work to have to decide, well, I think if we can get Professor Richardson, we should bring him into campus?
None at all. I mean, you know, the way our committee works is that there's about five faculty members, and we have five endowed lecture series, and everybody comes up with suggestions for who would be appropriate for the lecture series. So sometimes, you know, there's some dispute because different people have different people they'd like to bring. But I think Professor Richardson was a no-brainer, especially given that he's got Indiana roots. His father was active in the civil rights movement, and I think his brother still lives in Indianapolis.
When you talk about Professor Richardson's family being involved in the civil rights movement, what did his father do he's been able to, obviously, it's gone through the family to instill not only such a respect and interest for Dr. King, but the opportunity to be able to follow through on that higher law aspect that Dr. King lived by.
There I have to admit that I'm not real up on his father's biography. It's mm-hmm. actually something I want. I hope to get him to talk about while he's here. But I expect that he was a legal advisor to the civil rights movement involved in the NAACP because last time I was at a conference in Temple last year in Professor Richardson's honor, and you know, it was great to see a room full of his students and admirers who came to honor him. And there were people there from IU Indianapolis who mentioned that his father's portrait hangs in the law school there.
Oh, really? That's very interesting. Something to look forward to if you make it down to the campus in Indianapolis. Getting to the point of what Dr. Richardson hopes to talk about, did he tell you ahead of time what his thoughts about what he may bring up during the lecture coming up this week?
Right. So So I think his lecture, it really blends his interest in Martin Luther King as an embodiment of this notion of higher law and his interest in international law or comparative law in this case, because basically what he's – you know, the title is something like Martin Luther King and European Trumpism, mm-hmm. or Martin Luther King's beloved community and European Trumpism. So I think – from his perspective, the Trumpism stands for extreme nationalism and fear of immigrant communities. And he wants to contrast that vision, which is pervasive in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe. I think Brexit is also a part of it in his view. He wants to contrast that vision with Martin Luther King's vision for a sort of more cosmopolitan brotherhood of all humankind.
We're talking with Professor Jeremy Tellman, who is with the Valparaiso University School of Law. He is also on the committee and helping choose this year's Martin Luther King Jr. lecturer. And that lecturer, as we've mentioned, is Temple University law professor Henry Richardson III. And it would be wonderful to have him here. Does the lecture series allow for not only him to not only have his prepared remarks, but a chance to take a sort of a Q&A from those attending?
Yeah, the usual way it goes is the lecture lasts 45 minutes or so, and then there's 10 or 15 minutes for questions from the audience. But then we also have a reception immediately afterwards where there's an opportunity for more informal discussion. I'm lucky that as the host, I get to have dinner with him with a couple other colleagues, and we'll chat some more. And then the following day, we have a colloquium with faculty members and invited students where we delve into the ideas in greater detail.
We should mention that, of course, the lecture itself is going to be on Thursday, the 25th, and so that means he'll be able to spend Friday the 26th on campus as well, continuing his opportunity to enlighten people about what he knows and to have a chance for people to ask their questions of him. Then.
Right. So when we get somebody of Professor Richardson's caliber in town, we like to hang on to him for at least 24 hours.
Well, certainly, as you've got that planned out very nicely. Now, when you consider Dr. Richardson, and you know him so well from the work that you've done, the research that you have done about him as well. Are there any other people on the Valparaiso University School of Law who are familiar with his work, his thinking about, in this particular case, about international law?
You know, I don't know that there are other people on campus who are familiar with his work because he's mostly known in international law circles and mm-hmm. I'm sort of the last one. You know, our faculty has been shrinking of late.
Right.
And I think I'm the only one whose work is now focused on international law.
So I guess it will enlighten everybody. You're aware of him and you're aware of his work and the like, and so everybody will learn something from him, certainly from his views about life with the civil rights movement as well as how it's fit in well with international law. Economics and law right now.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing about our lecture series. It exposes our faculty and our students and hopefully the community if they're interested, because it's open to all, of course, to cutting edge thinking to which we have not been exposed.
Mm-hmm. In fact, speaking of which, if anyone from our listening audience is interested in attending the lecture on Thursday, tell us more about where it is and how they can come in.
Right. So it's at the law school in Valparaiso. It's 656 Greenwich Street, South Greenwich Street. You can type that into your GPS. Once you get to the law school, it's on the first floor in the Benson Hall at Benson classroom at 4 o'clock. But once you get to the law school, there'll be signs.
I'm sure there probably will. Maybe even if you're lucky, there'll be even signs outdoors for people to direct to make sure they get to the right building to be sure.
So. Yeah.
Are you, to say the least, you're very excited that he's coming here with a gentleman that I know that you no doubt respect greatly, and because of your experience and the research that you did in doing the review of his book, that you're probably looking forward to coming to Valparaiso University.
Absolutely.
That's great. That's great to hear. Once again, the speaker for this year's 2018 Martin Luther King Jr. Lecture is Professor Henry Richardson III. He's with the Beasley School of Law at Temple University. He's coming in to speak on Thursday, the 25th, and he'll also be on campus for some selected opportunities on Friday, the 26th as well for students and faculty and the like on campus. But the community is welcome to come to the lecture itself, and the lecture begins at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the Valparaiso University campus. And with us to tell us more about Professor Richardson, the guest speaker this year for the series, is Professor Jeremy Hellman. Thank you for coming in. We appreciate your comments and looking forward to hearing what he has to say. I'm sure that it's going to be quite enlightening and very, very informative for anybody who attends the lecture. And good and welcome to the students as well that have the opportunity to talk with him and get to enjoy the colloquium coming up on Friday. Thank you for joining us today to talk about this.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Well, my family was all born in Mexico in the town of Querétaro. And when I was born, they decided to come to the United States for a better future, but mostly to work. My mom, growing up, was very loving. I think she took pride in her kids because that's the only thing she had here besides my father. My father, he had to take on two jobs. So he was very busy, and I wouldn't really see him during the day. It was maybe in the morning, if I woke up early enough and I saw him going off to work, and he would come back at like midnight. So he would be gone basically all day. I remember that after high school, I was always a good student, but it was during my senior year in high school that I started seeing everybody else applying to schools and get really excited about what schools they were going to go to. But that wasn't really an option for me, knowing that I wasn't going to receive any federal aid. And I knew that I still wanted to continue studying, but I just didn't have the same options as my friends. So I decided to enroll in the community college. And a lot of people mocked it as the college of last chance. Even when I was going to get my associate's degree, and I was so close to obtaining it, I didn't know whether I would be able to transfer, because even more for me, it was a financial strain on my family, knowing that I wouldn't receive any federal aid. So I started doing research on my own, looking at scholarships, looking at what schools I could apply to, and kind of easing my parents into it. Although my mom, she would always be really supportive of me. She wanted me to continue, but it was a little bit harder for my dad, because he was the one making the most money, and it made me feel bad to have to ask him for his support in that way, because he's always worked really hard, and I feel like he's given me as much as he can. I started telling him at schools I was looking at, and this was obviously a school I was looking at because it was 2 hours from home, so it was close enough where I knew that my parents could come visit if I wanted them to. And he was very, very proud of me at that point. And I remember that he started crying. He started crying because he just didn't know if he could afford it. And I remember that when he started becoming more involved, he took a weekend off, and we visited schools that I had been accepted to. But he would never say much. He would just kind of look around, and I could start seeing my mom was the one that was getting very, very excited for me. She obviously wanted me to continue, and my dad did too, but in a different way. He wouldn't show it the same way. It was about 3 weeks before the semester would start, the fall semester would start, and the advisor I had spoken to here kept getting in contact with me, asking me whether I was gonna come here or not. They needed to know. I asked my dad and my mom whether I was gonna do it or not, and they just said yes, although they didn't know exactly how they would work it out. So I made the decision to come here like 2 weeks before the semester started, and I had nothing. I gathered everything. It was a rush. It was just a mess. But I came, and I remember, because obviously I did get some help financially, but it didn't cover everything. And my dad ended up taking, because I couldn't take out student loans, he ended up taking a loan from his 401k. And that's the way he was able to help me. And although I thought my parents would come to visit. They didn't come and visit as much as they wanted to because also like the gas money or just coming out here sometimes with work, it wouldn't work. It didn't work out as much. And that was my first year here.
You can find out more regional stories at welcomeprojectoneword.valpo.edu. Much is still unknown about Alzheimer's, a disease that will affect half the population if you live that long. There are no pharmaceutical treatments. Doctors cannot make a definitive diagnosis until after death with an autopsy. Research participants are in short supply, but Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that advances in brain imaging offer some hope, and a key piece of that work is being done right here in Indiana.
Alzheimer's disease is a puzzle for researchers. One problem, they don't definitively know what it looks like as it develops in the brain, but they're working on it.
To some extent, it's hubris on our part. You think about how difficult cancer is to understand.
This is Dr. Martin Farlow.
The complexity of the brain is many thousand times greater than solid organs that are affected by cancer. It's a very difficult target.
But he says advances in brain imaging promise some clarity. Farlow is a researcher at Indiana University's Department of Neurology and says imaging helps scientists define what the disease looks like in different stages.
It turns out that there are changes that start to occur that you can see on imaging studies, on the MRIs, on the tau PETs, on the amyloid PETs.
New tools like positron emissions tomography, or PET scans, can show radioactive tracers that bind to proteins and neurofiber tangles of the brain. In someone with Alzheimer's, these tau proteins no longer function properly, and scientists can see that.
Why is this important? It gives us a map. It allows us to understand what the disease actually does as it progresses.
This work is part of the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, or ADNI, which studies people over 55. It's a multi-site, long-term push to map later life changes in brain function. One of its arms is in Indianapolis at the IU Neuroscience Center. Farlow says the center brings together some of the best brains in brains.
Clinicians in neurology, psychiatry, neurosurgery, and researchers also are all brought together in the same building.
This particular study site recruits older adults without any symptoms of Alzheimer's or with symptoms of the disease in its early stages. This makes it easier for them to find participants, a big challenge in Alzheimer's research. Alzheimer's Association Greater Indiana Chapter Program Director Denise Saxman says this is in part because of the disease itself.
As the disease progresses, they lack attention, they lack the ability to sit still. Some of the things that you need to be doing to participate in clinical trials, and it just makes it a lot harder.
The Indianapolis study site has been able to recruit participants fairly well, but they're still looking to fill a few spots. 71-year-old Rita Brown connected with the Indy trial site while doing research after her husband died from a degenerative brain disease. She has no signs of Alzheimer's, just normal age-related memory loss. So she began to explore her cognitive abilities online.
And they would periodically send you little tests to do, and they would measure your changes.
They also asked if she might have a study partner who could go through the process with her.
And I says, how about a twin sister?
Her identical twin, Carol Howlett, wasn't surprised when she got the call.
She's always getting me into strange things, so...
Being able to look inside the twins' brains is a unique opportunity. The researchers will be able to account for different factors that may play into cognition and function, which could draw a clear map and lead to a more confident early diagnosis. And Howlett says that would be a blessing.
I would rather know that 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, I'm not going to remember anything, so that way I can get out and do such things that I enjoy, traveling and other things.
Scientists say ultimately the goal is to detect changes and treat people before they develop Alzheimer's symptoms. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Lieutenant Governor Crouch, let's talk a little bit about the recent Ag Opioid Symposium. How did things go with that, and what has been the latest that you have received on how the state government is trying to deal with this problem?
We have an opioid epidemic here in the state of Indiana, and we have one, quite honestly, all over the country. And so those stakeholders coming together to actually have a symposium to address the issue was extremely encouraging and a great first step towards addressing the issue. As the lieutenant governor, I oversee 5 agencies, and I also am secretary of agriculture and rural development. So my portfolio has a very, very strong focus on rural Indiana. And opioids are extremely critical area in rural Indiana. 1 out of 5 Hoosiers is facing some kind of addiction or a mental health challenge. And so there probably isn't a one of us in this state, Chris, who does not know a family, perhaps our own, who is facing this challenge. So our ability to be able to address the opioid epidemic is going to have positive effects on Hoosiers and Hoosier families, but also on economic development and just rural Indiana in general. So what we are doing is we are coming forward and we are addressing the issue at the legislative level and at the executive level on all fronts: prevention, treatment, and enforcement. And we see a number of bills moving through the Indiana General Assembly to help us address the opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. And we know it's only if we all work together that we're going to ensure that those who are suffering are going to get the help and the treatment they need. Now, one of the important issues that was addressed at the symposium was the Family and Social Services Agency has instituted an anti-stigma campaign because so many people do not understand that addiction is a disease. And so by removing the stigma that the disease is something that we can get help for, it is a way to increase access to treatment for Hoosiers. So a number of important steps that we're taking to move forward in addressing this issue, and extremely important for Indiana, because if we're truly going to have a legacy of excellence in this state, we must lift up all Hoosiers to the next level, including those with disabilities, those with mental health challenges, and those facing drug and alcohol addiction. Mm-hmm.
I know that you've just mentioned briefly here about economic development. I know that that is one area that you get to supervise as a lieutenant governor, in particular the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. And Governor Holcomb has mentioned several times during his visits here in Northwest Indiana and his statements statewide. In fact, he made some brief mention as well, too, in the latest State of the State address he had, talking about making sure that communities across the state, including Northwest Indiana, and we're talking mainly about smaller communities, not necessarily the big cities, that everybody gets a fair shake at being able to attract more economic development to their particular communities. What's the latest you can tell us the IEDC and other organizations that you get to work with are doing in that respect?
Well, first of all, the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, or the IEDC, as you've mentioned, are able to achieve great success because Indiana is in such strong fiscal condition, Chris. And it isn't something that happened overnight. It's the result of 12 years of fiscal leadership that Indiana is in a position to lead the Midwest and the country. And let me share a few statistics with you. Mm-hmm. Indiana leads the country in advanced manufacturing. We are number 1 in the Midwest and number 5 in the country for our business environment. We have the 3rd best infrastructure in the country. We're one of 12 states that has a AAA credit bond rating by all 3 independent rating agencies. And I share that with you because the fact that the state is in sound fiscal condition, it allows the economy to grow in our local areas and in our local communities. And there in Northwest Indiana, we have seen great success. You know, Abraham Lincoln said, "The fact that some achieve great success is proof to all that others can achieve it." And in Northwest Indiana, you have achieved some great success. The Indiana Economic Development Corporation has secured and worked with your local economic development groups to secure 15 commitments in Northwest Indiana, investing more than $5 million in creating over 1,200 new jobs. Mm-hmm. And some of those are the HMD Trucking, which is a transportation and logistics service provider, MCP USA, manufacturer of ready-made meal trays, American Renalit, which is the manufacturer of high-quality plastic films. It is the leadership at your local level working with the leadership at the state level that is allowing these successes. And the Indiana Economic Development Corporation in 2017 created 30,000 new jobs, which broke the record back in 2012 of 27,000. Now, the governor said, that's great, but we need to try to do even better. And he has charged the Indiana Economic Development Corporation to creating 35,000 jobs in 2018. So I believe that Northwest Indiana is going to continue to see additional economic development activity as you all grow along with the rest of the state.
We're talking with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch about some of the issues that she gets to supervise as the number two person in state government. And Lieutenant Governor Crouch, we know that the General Assembly is moving along with their current session here. Can you give us an update on how they're doing on some of the issues that I know that you and Governor Holcomb have emphasized that they'd like to see lawmakers work on this session?
In the 13 years I have been associated with the Indiana General Assembly, 8 years as a state representative from Southwest Indiana, 3 years as auditor of state, and now my second year as lieutenant governor, I have never experienced a more collaborative, cooperative civil session than last year's and this current session. Mm-hmm. And that is due to the leadership of Governor Holcomb, but also the bipartisan cooperation in the Indiana General Assembly. And so we are seeing legislators come together and working across the aisle to promote and to pass legislation that benefits Hoosiers and enriches their lives. And some of the bills that we are seeing moving through the Senate, and I share the Senate specifically because as Lieutenant Governor, I am president of the Senate.
Right.
And Chris, I've got to tell you that as a former state representative for 8 years, it's gratifying to finally be in charge of the senator. So, but we are seeing some bills moving through the Senate that would be eligible for amendment is Senate Bill 139, which is the investigation of overdose deaths. And so in order for us to have a true picture of our opioid epidemic, we need to ensure that our coroners are all investigating and are reporting uniformly those overdose deaths. And so we are seeing that. We will see that on the agenda to be available for amendments, and that bill is moving through the session. In addition, in the Senate, also, which will be on the calendar and also available for amendments, is Senate Bill 221, which deals with the INSPECT program. And what that bill does is it will require physicians to actually register and enter into the INSPECT database when they are prescribing opioids so that they can detect those patients who are abusing the opioids. In addition, there are bills moving through the House dealing with the opioid epidemic. One in particular, House Bill 1359, which has been reassigned to Ways and Means, and it will look at creating new felonies for drug overdoses or people that manufacture drugs that cause overdose deaths. A number of bills moving through the session. We are optimistic and encouraged by the session and by the, as I had mentioned earlier, the bipartisan cooperation and looking forward to great outcomes for Hoosiers all over our state.
Well, it certainly sounds like all of the lawmakers working together in both the Senate as well as the Indiana House very concerned about the opioid epidemic and doing what they can to see these measures get through that will help the agencies across the state deal with this problem and trying to stem the flow of the opioids causing so many problems for so many Hoosiers. And it sounds like there's a lot of other issues, too, that I know that you and the governor are keeping an eye on, and we'll see how things develop, I guess, in the days and weeks ahead, as long as the lawmakers are together. And we thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us about these issues, in particular about the opioid epidemic. We've been talking with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. Appreciate your comments today and hope we have a chance to chat again here before the General Assembly session finishes up.
I look forward to it, Chris. Thank you.
NIPSCO is continuing to work with residents to help keep the heat on by assisting them in paying their winter heating bills. Denise Rodriguez with NIPSCO talked with us about what the utility can do to help.
NIPSCO actually has a few energy assistance programs to help with utility bills and assistance. So we have from state and federal assistance programs to we also partner with community action agencies, township trustees, and also in-house we have payment agreements. So we just basically ask anybody, you know, if you're struggling, you know, if you think you can't make ends meet, just please give us a call at 1-800-4-NIPSCO, and, you know, our customer service agents will take a look at your bill, ask you a few questions, and just basically help you and connect you with the best possible option for you and in your situation. Mm-hmm.
The program, I know, is based a lot on what the income is for a family, depending on how the size of the family is. Tell us how the breakout is here, the important things that people need to know so they know whether they actually qualify.
Depending on your family size, all of that information is located on our website. Mm-hmm. It's on NIPSCO.com/payment assistance. There's quite a few numbers in here. Instead of me rattling them off, I think it would just be easier for people to either visit our website or, like I said, just give our customer service agents a call, because they could easily, just ask you those simple questions and just lead you directly to that information.
I guess,
but for state and federal funding, that assistance is limited. So first, it comes on a first-come, first-served basis.
Right. That's the important thing that I guess depends on what kind of help that you're looking for, whether you're looking for help from NIPSCO in trying to deal with your bills and that sort of thing, or whether you're looking for some type of grant. And that's where the community action agencies come into play too, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Okay. When you take a look at the things you need to know for being able to deal with paying your bills, NIPSCO, as you mentioned, NIPSCO has a number of other assistance programs besides the official one that is in effect for this time of year with the heating costs and all. Tell us a little bit some of the other programs that NIPSCO has that work in conjunction or alongside this particular program.
With the LIHEAP program, there's also the NIPSCO CARE program. So if you are approved for LIHEAP, you are basically automatically enrolled in our NIPSCO CARE program, which also provides another reduction in percentage of your bill. And I think that ranges between 11 and 26%. Mm-hmm. It just depends on, you know, the criteria that helped with your LIHEAP, with that information that you had provided with us. Along with that, there's also the NIPSCO Hardship Program, and that's energy assistance for customers who fall between 151 and 200% of the federal poverty level. Those numbers are also on our website at NIPSCO.com/payment assistance. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, we also work with township trustees and community action agencies to kind of lead you in the right direction. Maybe there's another grant that you could get, like, in your community, and as I mentioned, a payment agreement. So basically what the payment agreement does, it allows you to make an initial payment within 4 days of the agreement, and then you spread the remaining unpaid balance over a couple of months. Any of those programs, you know, if you're interested in or to see if you qualify, we strongly encourage anybody to give us a call.
It's really important, in particular, if you have a situation where you're unable to be able to pay your electric or your natural gas heating bill and you're up against disconnection, you have to do something pretty quickly, don't you? And you have to make sure that the folks at NIPSCO know about the problem.
Yes, just like any other thing, you know, we want to make sure that you're safe. We want to make sure that you're warm and you have electricity and you have everything you need this winter. Because, you know, as you know, we live in the Midwest, so one day it can be 20 degrees and the next it can be 65.
That's right.
So we just want to make sure that everyone's safe and warm. And, even if you're just a little bit worried, if you're unsure, just please give us a call, because the sooner you call us, the easier it is for us to help and the more room we have to work with you and just lead you in the right direction.
This is Denise Rodriguez with NIPSCO. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Sheriff Martinez, thanks for joining us again here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you very much, Chris. Great to be on.
Let's pick things up here from, I guess, kind of where we left off. One of the things we wanted to talk a little bit about today is about the Drug Task Force Highway Interdiction Team. What is this all about? And give us an update on how we're dealing with our problems with crime as well as narcotics in Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely. What we did is the Highway Drug Interdiction Unit was dismantled about 7 years ago, just when the height or the peak of the opioid problem just, you know, started. And the interdiction unit, what they do is work on the interstates, Interstate 8094, Interstate 90, which is the toll road, I-65, U.S. 30, and also U.S. 41. And these officers are highly trained officers to detect possible criminal activity there on our roadways. And it's about making high-volume traffic stops. And their training and experience to detect possible drug smugglers or contraband or weapons. And it's been very successful in the past. Our officers have started to make some pretty good seizures out there. And it's pretty much a large bulk of narcotics. It could be heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, marijuana, that are transported in these vehicles, either through a suicide load, which a suicide load is the definition of drugs that are just placed in the cargo area or in the trunk, mm-hmm. pretty much no concealment technique used or effort to conceal it. Or some of the vehicles are use high-tech, you know, elaborate traps that our officers are also trained to detect, where, you know, some of the narcotics will be concealed in the gas tanks and the tires, you know, and the a false bottom of the floorboard, the ceiling or headliner of a vehicle. You know, they spend a lot of money in these traps to get these drugs worth in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, that's being transported on our highways. But there's also U.S. currency, illegal U.S. currency that's being trafficked on our highways, the profits, the proceeds of these contrabands or narcotics that is being moved, you know, to a source city, let's say Chicago, and then being moved back to the organization. And, you know, we've come across 400,000, 500,000. I know at 1 year our unit has seized in 2000, I believe, and 10, we seized about $1.5 million for the year. And
wow.
And that is, you know, great for the police department, great for the drug task force, and great for taxpayers because that money can be used for training and equipment when we seize the money.
Well, it sounds like that the Highway Interdiction Team is getting back into business again at certainly the right time here, as we mentioned earlier, the opioid crisis now at epidemic stages here in Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely, and it goes further than just going after the drug traffickers and stopping the flow of drugs. As you know, we do have an opioid problem epidemic here in Lake County, as we do all over the country, and I believe Indiana is the ranked number 17th in the country in the opioid overdose deaths. I know in 2016, we had, I believe, an approximate amount is about 114 overdose deaths in 2016. And last year, we broke that record. I believe it was somewhere in the range of 180 overdose deaths. And that deals with opioid or fentanyl or heroin, and it's a major problem. So we have a major addiction problem as well, and we need to address that. So it's not just about going after the drug traffickers. It's not about just putting the drug dealers in jail. But now it's about recovery. It's about, you know, helping those that come through our jail. The addicts will steal from their own family to continue to buy this drug to get that you know, euphoria or that high. But when they're stealing or committing these thefts to sustain their drug habit, they're committing a crime. And we see them a lot in our jail. And that's a great opportunity where we can address this addiction problem. And that's the steps that we are taking in our jail, starting a program where, we get a qualified candidate that can go through this program. Right now it's on a volunteer basis, and hopefully getting with the judges, it can be a mandated, an alternative to prosecution for these addicts, a path to recovery. And going through detox in our jail, going through a program with a narcotic called Vivitrol. And Vivitrol is it's a narcotic that blocks the opioid receptors in your brain. So it lasts for 28 days, and you do not get that urge or want to get, that the effects of opioids. And it works also for alcohol. So it lasts for 28 days. And I know we're partnering up with the organization to get Vivitrol supplied to us in the jail at no cost, because that cost Vivitrol, you're looking at about $1,200 to $1,800. Mm-hmm. And working a partnership with these other programs and organizations when they leave our jail, getting them signed up for Medicaid or any grants to continue this recovery process. It's, I think, our duty as leaders, as elected officials, and as human beings, to help this recovery process. They're not junkies. They're not. They don't deserve this. This is an addiction. This is an illness, and we're losing a lot of loved ones. People are losing a lot of loved ones because of this terrible narcotic.
We're talking with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. And you were referring to the problems with the opioid crisis that we face in the region, and how you're trying to deal with it there on the level at the Lake County Sheriff's Department and the Lake County Jail. Let's take a look now at the other parts of what happens at the jail in this particular case, and the inmates and their health care in particular. I know that you've been working very hard on getting some improvements to the health care process at the jail. Tell us the update there.
Absolutely. Well, right now what we have, that every inmate that comes into our jail, we do start the process to get them signed up or enrolled into to Medicaid, so they can get that activated when they leave our jail and continue any of the medications or treatment that they were getting here in our jail. Another thing is our mental health ward or division, and we do have several personnel that are qualified mental health professionals. Now, one of the things about having our qualified mental health professionals, which we call our QMHP, is that they have some certifications. Now, we do have about six of them that are fully certified and licensed, and we have about four that are almost there. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about, being the sheriff as an administrator is being fiscally responsible and making sure that everyone receives their certification. So one of the things I have done is I have reduced the pay on those four qualified mental health professionals to make sure they get that last part of their certification, and those who are fully certified get the pay, the necessary pay, or the pay that they deserve that's been budgeted.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that I know we talked about last time and has come up lately here as far as improvements at the Lake County Jail is dealing with the search for you to have the right leadership, and in this case having the right qualified leadership. I recall last time that we had an issue here where the Lake County Jail warden had to be released because he wasn't quite qualified in that role. What's the status in trying to find a replacement for that position?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking that. It's going very well. We've done a nationwide search for a qualified jail administrator, which is a jail warden. And we're down to two right now. One is nearby around the Chicagoland area, and one that's from New Hampshire. And we're very excited. They seem very qualified, many years of experience in the federal, state, and local level. And we feel confident that within the next few weeks, if not next month, we should have one selected. And I'm very satisfied and proud of the selection process that we have done. And I think that once we come when we finally make that final decision, that he will be the best qualified candidate or individual mm-hmm. to be our Lake County Jail Warden.
That's great. And going along with being an administrator for the jail as a whole, I know one of the tasks they have is to make sure that the processes, not only in health care, but also the kind of food that the inmates get to have while they're locked up is important.
We do have our own kitchen here that mm-hmm. food does get delivered here to our Lake County Jail. We do have a kitchen and cooks, staff here, and it's a unique situation. We're always looking for cost-saving measures or ways that we can do this in feeding our prisoners and making sure they get the proper nutrition that they need. So, you know, I'm looking at possibly contracting out a food service. Doesn't mean that because I'm looking at that there's going to be cost savings, but it's keeping our options open, and we're looking at other ways that we can save taxpayers money. But just understand that this is a large population of, you know, a little mini city of individuals here in our jail, and every single one sometimes required a specific diet, and we have to make sure that that is provided for them, or for any type of allergies or anything. It's our responsibility that, you know, they're getting the proper nutrition, that they're fed properly, and, you know, making sure that the well-being of our inmates here in our jail is top priority.
Finally, Sheriff Martinez, if you will give us an update on what you have planned here for the rest of 2018. We've covered a lot of things, and a lot of things, of course, are issues that are ongoing, not only the ones at the Lake County Jail, but dealing with the problems with narcotics in our region and the opioid epidemic. What else is on your agenda for the Lake County Sheriff's Department for 2018?
Like I said, the very most important thing is, you know, meeting the requirements for the Department of Justice, and I think we're doing that. And hopefully with the warden, that will be one step forward to getting from under the Department of Justice mandate. The next thing is I think we're pretty close as well as getting a psychiatric nurse practitioner that is required under the Department of Justice in our jail. One thing I'm proud to announce that within the last every month since I've taken office, our overtime has been going down in our jail, and it's about allocating the proper manpower and resources inside the jail to bring the overtime down, and that's important. The other thing is instilling the integrity and professionalism back into the Lake County Sheriff's Department and the organization as a whole. I can tell you morale is up. The men and women of this organization are excited, and I do see the support here within our own organization. And another thing that we're doing and moving forward is educating our public, with the opioid problem. We already did one class or one session here at the Lake County Government Center of Narcan training.
Right.
And what we did here is it's for the public. It's for the citizens. We are empowering them. So many times they feel helpless. And when they're calling 911, when they see their loved one, they're overdosed and not breathing. And they're waiting for first responders, either medics or police officers, to get there and give them that first dosage or shot of Narcan. Well, we're going out there countywide, training our community on the use of Narcan, empowering them. That way they don't feel helpless, and they can be that first responder. It's very important, that first initial, shot of Narcan to that victim that is overdosing. And, we're providing a lot of, things that we're going to do for our community.
Mm-hmm. And Sheriff, it sounds like a lot of great things underway. Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. with us. Thank you very much for
today.
Thank
you very much, Chris. It was great to be on.
That's Rich Lee speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.
Program support comes from NIPSCO. It's why.